Darian Woods.
Stacy.
Welcome to the show. You have come to us with a story that was inspired by some of the news that you've been watching in the last few weeks.
That's right. I just couldn't get my eyes off those videos of the protesters in Hong Kong. They're protesting this extradition bill that might see more people being extradited to China, which they see as a real threat to their civil liberties.
Right, because Hong Kong's been, I mean, they are part of China, but they also are independent.
That's right. One country, two systems.
And Darian, you also work at Planet Money, so your economist brain kicked in, and you started wondering about protests in general. Like, how do you know if a protest is going to be successful? What are the elements a protest needs to succeed?
And I didn't want theories.
No.
I wanted an evidence-based recipe.
Very economist-y.
Like a cake that is just proven again and again.
A recipe for a successful revolution.
Two academics might have come up with that number.
This is The Indicator from Planet Money. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Darian Woods. Today on the show, a revolution by the numbers.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Capital One Saver Card. Earn 4% cash back on dining and entertainment, 2% at grocery stores, and 1% on all other purchases. Now when you go out, you cash in. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Terms apply. Support also comes from Microsoft. Today, innovators are using artificial intelligence to transform how we work, from the way we grow our food to the way we brew our beer. See how AI is empowering business innovators at Microsoft.com/AI.
So, how do you make a successful revolution? What are the elements you need?
Erica Chenoweth is a public policy professor at Harvard. And when she was a student, she studied terrorism and civil war. And she came to the conclusion that, like it or not, guns, tanks, bombs, they work.
Right. Like, if you are launching a revolution or a protest and you want to affect major change, you have to bring the firepower. That was the conclusion she came to. Until 2006.
She met her match. Nonviolence researcher Maria Steffen.
Maria was a lot more optimistic about the potential success of nonviolent resistance.
Maria and Erica would debate late into the evenings. Erica saying, no, if you want a successful revolution, you've got to bring the guns. And Maria saying, no, guns don't work. That is not the way to make change. And then one night, Maria laid out a challenge to Erica.
She said, if you're really skeptical about nonviolent resistance, how would you prove that?
So Erica looked into the numbers. She made a list of campaigns to overthrow a government or for declaring independence. She trawled through 323 campaigns worldwide from 1900 up to that point. Then she compared violent versus nonviolent campaigns.
Nonviolent campaigns from 1900 to 2006 had succeeded about twice as often as the violent campaigns.
When you started to find these results, were you surprised?
Yes, I was surprised. I expected for there to be basically at best, no significant difference between armed and unarmed action.
Erica and Maria teamed up to write a paper and then a book called Why Civil Resistance Works.
Bottom line, Maria was right. Erica was wrong. If you want a successful protest or revolution, nonviolence works.
Was she graceful that her hunch was correct?
Yeah. Maria is an incredibly graceful person.
Of course she is. She's the peaceful one. Don't you think?
I haven't met Maria, but, you know, she seems like she'll be easy to get along with. So peaceful resistance isn't going to work for everyone. If you showed up to the capital city with a banner and three friends, you'll be ignored.
Well, it depends who your three friends are. What if your friends are Kim and Kanye?
You might be listened to then, but even then, I mean...
You'd get press anyway. Still, in general, ingredient number one for successful protest or revolution is nonviolence. Leave the guns at home.
But you need numbers, too.
Right, numbers.
Ingredient number two, how much of the population do you need to have a successful revolution?
Yeah, how many people need to be marching around in the streets for change to happen?
One of the kind of frequently asked questions that I'd gotten from activists was how many people it takes. What's the threshold?
And this makes sense, right? I mean, the more participants you have in a protest, the higher the chance of success. This is very logical. But as Erica and Maria found, there was this one number, this one threshold. And after you cross that number, this percentage of the population participating in these protests, the likelihood of success of the protests or revolution became almost inevitable.
You know, above that 3.5% threshold, there hadn't been any failed movements.
3.5%. If 3.5% of the population or more participated in a protest or a revolution, it was basically guaranteed to succeed. And that is today's indicator, 3.5%.
That's true in the Philippines, the People Power Revolution in 1986. 3.6% of the population, they got rid of the president at the time, Ferdinand Marcos.
2003, the Rose Revolution in Georgia, 4.7% of the population came out, got rid of the president at the time.
Estonia's Singing Revolution between 1987 and 1991, 19% of the population, also successful. It's not often in the social sciences that you get like a 100% of the time this has happened. Often it's, you know, probability or maybe this or maybe that, but that is every single of the recorded instances over the last 100 years or so, it's been successful.
Yeah, and that was a little surprising to me in the sense that it's a pretty small threshold of participation.
I mean, 3.5% of a population is tiny. You'd think for a revolution to be successful, for a revolution to affect change, you'd need way more of the population out into the streets than 3.5%. Still, if you think about it, I mean, in a country the size of the United States, 3.5% is 11 million people. Even the Women's March in 2017 didn't come close to that. That was the largest single-day demonstration in the history of the U.S., and Erica estimates it was only about 1.3% of the U.S. population.
Erica is also quick to say that these successful movements probably had more than 3.5% of the population sympathetic to the cause.
Right, that like 3.5 is just the people out in the streets.
Exactly. So there'll be other people who are going about their usual jobs agreeing with the campaign.
My guess is that in cases where you do like approach this really large threshold of participation, there's overwhelming support for the movement.
So you're saying that this is kind of the tip of the iceberg almost.
Exactly. Yeah. Because in any given movement, it's only the most committed people that are actually engaged in mass mobilization. If a movement just tries to organize 3.5% of the population because they think that there's a rule and they should try to apply it.
But then 96.5% disagree, yeah. Then it may not be as successful.
Exactly.
Which brings us back to the protests in Hong Kong. There are an estimated 2 million people pouring through the streets. That is nearly 30% of the Hong Kong population.
So on one measure, the protests were huge. But if you're looking at China as a whole, that number of protesters is actually a tiny fraction.
Yeah, to get to that 3.5% threshold for China, for the whole country, the magic number would be 49 million.
For Hong Kong itself, the government has started to back down. They've suspended the extradition bill. Now, people are still marching in the streets and blockading government buildings, but overall, those streams of millions of protesters has dispersed for the time being.
So it is unclear if the Hong Kong protests have all the ingredients for a successful revolution. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. This episode was produced by Darius Rafieyan, edited by Patty Hirsch, and fact-checked by Emily Lang. The Indicator is a production of NPR.
If you want to read more about Erica and Maria's research, sign up for the Planet Money newsletter. Short, fun essays about the economy. Straight to your email inbox once a week. Go to npr.org/planetmoneynewsletter.
Drag has been around for a while.
In the kabuki tradition in Japan, in minstrel shows, in vaudeville.
But one TV show made it mainstream now. We break down drag's current renaissance. Check out NPR's It's Been a Minute now.